Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day.
Have you been working hard to dominate your surgical residency?
Do you want to help others to dominate no matter what stage of training they're in? Hi to all of our BTK listeners. My name is Nina Clark, general surgery resident at the University of Washington.
And I'm Jessica Millar, general surgery resident at the University of Michigan. We both have had the privilege of working as Behind the Knife education fellows for the past year, and we're excited to continue growing our team.
Are you a surgical resident interested and enthusiastic about surgical education? BTK is offering a two-year surgical education fellowship starting July 1st, 2023 and ending June 30th, 2025.
Only residents who are starting a two-year block of professional development time away from full-time clinical activity will be considered, and you have to ensure that your institution and mentor approve of this fellowship.
Fellows will be deeply involved in the BTK activities. The two of us have worked on an ab site revamp, knot tying video series, our new trauma video atlas, and a comprehensive student resource, just to start. While this is an unpaid internship, you'll have access to all the Behind the Knife resources like illustrators, editors, recording and video equipment, and more to help make high quality surgical education content.
Applications are due April 16th, and you can find the link to the application in our show notes or on our Twitter page at Behind the Knife. You can also contact us at hello@behindtheknife.org with any questions.
We've had a great time so far this year, and there's only more to come.
We hope you'll consider joining us.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Behind the Knife. After a long time, this is your host, Shreya Gupta, coming back on air to discuss a very sensitive topic. A couple weeks ago, you heard us talk about the episode with Dr. Romero Arenas, shedding some light on the Latinos, especially commenting on the underrepresented in medicine. Today, to discuss this topic further, we have Dr. Edward Barksdale. Dr. Barksdale is a pediatric surgeon. He's the surgeon in chief at Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital in University Hospitals, Cleveland. He did his medical school at Yale, followed by medical school as well as general surgery residency at Mass Gen, and finally, pediatric surgery at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. He is the surgeon in chief, like we said, and a professor at Case Western Reserve University. And I'm very excited to have him on our podcast today, as he's been a mentor to me for several years during my residency. Dr. Barksdale was the president of the American Pediatric Surgical Association pretty recently, and he's also served as the president of the Society of Black Academic Surgeons from 2013 to 2014. So who better to like comment on this very sensitive topics that we would love to discuss on our podcast on Behind the Knife? Dr. Barksdale, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Shreya, thank you. Dr. Gupta, thank you so much for letting me join you tonight. And you know, one of the things I learned a long time ago, never ever correct your mentees or proteges, because they're going to be smarter than you are and your boss one day. I know you'll be my boss, but I don't want to offend my allegiances. So it's Yale College and Harvard Medical School. And so I am a Yalie at heart. That's why you said Yale Medical School, but I went to Harvard Medical School and then trained at the Mass General. So, yeah.
All right. And this is Nina. I'm one of the other Behind the Knife fellows this year. I was fortunate to get to interview Dr. Romero Arenas last week. So this is great to kind of continue the conversation about these important issues. Dr. Barksdale, really to just kick this off, we're interested in hearing your thoughts on the status of underrepresented in medicine trainees as a whole. And specifically, Black trainees, how many of our surgeons in training identify as Black, and how big is that gap when you compare it to the overall United States population and our patient populations who we're treating?
So you've probably seen the same reports that I have, and I've been speaking about this for a few years. But as you know, the United States population is anywhere from about 12.5% to 13.7% African-American, and probably about 18% to 20% Hispanic. And what we know is that that level of representation is not reflected in the halls of academic or other medical centers. And when we look at Indigenous peoples, when we look at certain groups of Asians who are underrepresented, certainly we have what I've written, miles to go before we sleep. And I think the most recent paper that came out is actually a call to action for our entire field to think about how we can enhance representation, not for representation's sake or diversity's sake, but for the quality of patient care that we can provide by having a diverse workforce.
One of the articles that we read in kind of thinking about this issue was in particular dealing with the experience of Black and other underrepresented in medicine trainees and the differences in residency and in medical school that those folks experience. So I'm curious your thoughts on really what those differences are and how underrepresented in medicine trainees approach training. And we've heard both good and bad things about that experience. And so I'm curious your thoughts on that issue.
So I'm going to say something to you that I probably will regret. I'm an old guy now. When I look in the mirror, I see gray hair, but I feel like I was when I just left medical school to start my internship. And so the reason that age is important is I recognize that my lived experience as a resident from 1984 to 1992 is very different now. So now I think it's about 5.7% of residents are African American. When I trained in surgery at the Mass General, I think it's the second largest training program in the country. I was the fifth African American to train and the first in 1992 to be the super chief resident along with Lent Johnson. So our numbers were much less than they are now, although there are many more African Americans across the spectrum entering medical school and residency than when I went through. The number of African American men is actually lower than when I came through. But the point that I want to make is that, and I'll send you a picture that shows me as my fifth year, the true chief resident, not super chief resident year. I'm the only African American in the picture. And my experience as a resident was actually great. I did not feel, there are times that I felt isolated, but who doesn't feel isolated when they are a surgical resident working every other night? I didn't experience some of the issues of microaggressions or other issues, although I did have one situation I'll tell you about. But I think that as the numbers have increased, and I think particularly in the last 6 to 8 years in this country, the dialogue has begun to change and people feel that people who are not like them, minorities, women, LGBTQ, are taking a place away from them in medical school, and it's creating unnecessary animosity. And so I think that there are many issues, and it may be easiest so that I don't get into a soliloquy to kind of take your questions one at a time and give you my perspective. But the main point that I say that when I came along as one of the onlys, I don't think it is as tough as it is now when there are multiple minorities within a class. And there may be a greater sense of isolation, even if there's camaraderie.
That's definitely something that I think has borne out in the news and in social media, that idea of, you know, this feeling of displacement. If somebody else has this spot in these elite mm-hmm. systems, then that means somebody else didn't get it, right? And it's really striking to hear that kind of said out loud. And frankly, when you compare it to the complete lack of underrepresented minorities, they're still underrepresented, right, in our training yes. programs. So when you look at the numbers and then compare it to that sense of people taking somebody else's spot, I think it's really striking. I'm curious how you clearly as an old guy in your words, have
thank
mentored.
You for acknowledging that.
Only in your words, right? Not mine.
Yeah.
But I think that puts you in a position of having now mentored many people probably who fit into one or many of these categories. So I'm curious to hear a little bit of your thoughts on the positives that come from being, you know, maybe not the very first in their programs who are Latino or Black, but one of several and now, you know, blazing new trails, and how that has really benefited them, that background.
So I'll speak from my own perspective, and then I can speak from that of those that I have mentored. I tell people I am an African-American male, cisgendered, who was born and raised in the South at the end of what's called the Jim Crow era, or at the end of segregation. That deeply colors who I am, in the sense that there are certain levels of environmental trauma that I grew up, the structural racism. And for me, injustice ran through the streets that I grew up in, like rainwater after a storm running to a street drain. And so it often was that you got caught up in that level of injustice. You came to develop a relatively thick skin for certain things that if you got completely caught up in the microaggressions, the macroaggressions, the isolation, then you would never make it even out of that hometown. And so one of the advantages for me is having grown up in the environment that I grew up in, it gave me a level of strength in the environments that I subsequently went in for training. I hate the term resilience. This concept of resilience for me is bouncing back. I love the term anti-fragile, which means that from chaos or disorder, you become stronger in those broken places, as Hemingway wrote about in Farewell to Arms. So Lynchburg, Virginia made me anti-fragile. And the experiences that might have broken me that I didn't have as a child, I was prepared for. Resilience to me means bouncing back. My experience prepared me to bounce forward after falling. And so there were certain advantages for me that existed in those times, and it allowed me to not take myself, my negative experiences, so harshly. I must say, before I talk about the people I've mentored, I have actually felt more microaggressions and more difficulties the further that I have progressed along my career. When I finished my fellowship training, a prestigious training in pediatric surgery, I can remember going to Pittsburgh Children's and one of the residents, of all people, telling me, it's people like you that took my place at Harvard Medical School or at the MGH. And I was appalled. I was named the super chief resident at the MGH. There were 10 other people not of color who didn't get selected. And I took that in a somewhat insulting way, but I moved on. However, I have described it as you rise up the mountain, or if you rise up Mount Everest as a woman, as a minority, the air gets thin and the path gets treacherous. And you have to be careful with your footsteps that you don't fall off the mountain. The best thing for success is having a Sherpa, that is someone who knows the path to the top and someone who can help you. And I talk about this Sherpa in the classic way that people who know me, who I make metaphor, but that Sherpa is something more than a mentor. That's a person who can be a sponsor. So that takes me to the younger trainees, the people that I have both mentored and sponsored. The advantage of a mentor, particularly someone who's a little bit more senior, is they can help you understand the terrain before you get there. A mentor advises, a sponsor kind of decides for you. And so having a sponsor is, in my mind, more the Sherpa. That's someone who's taken that role. That's someone who says, stop, let's move quickly. Don't step there. That's a false area. And what I've learned in the mentorship and sponsorship is that I feel that in your generation, people are experiencing much more trauma than I did. The trauma I felt was that people didn't look to mentor me because I didn't look like what they envisioned a leader would be. Now I think that people are almost purposely ignored. And the goal for those of us like me who have excelled to some degree is to be equal opportunity mentors and sponsors. I'm proud to say that I don't wear this as a badge of courage. I have Black men, Black women, white women, white men, Asians of both genders, and I have several LGBTQI protégés, not just mentees, but protégés, people I've sponsored, including a transgender man who I'm really proud of, almost as though he is my son, or I should say they are my protégé. I won't even add a gender to that. But anyway, I think there's such a great importance for mentorship and sponsorship as two separate things. Told you I'd give you a soliloquy, so you should have cut me off.
No, that's exactly what we're looking for. And I think that really blends in well with something that I wanted to bring up, is this underrepresented in medicine and the recent press that it has mm-hmm. gathered in resident as well as faculty attrition rates. And especially, you know, in Black, in Latinos, in mm-hmm. females. And so can you tell us a little bit, what do you think is the issue here? Where mm-hmm. are the major leaky parts that we need to be cognizant of?
Well, such a complex question. And I think that when you look at the pipeline, there's a great diagram of the leaky pipeline. It was initially, I think, designed for women in medicine, and it shows where people fall out. When I look at my own life and my own experience, my mother never graduated high school. She was a seamstress in a sock factory. My father graduated high school. He was a mailman. And the challenge that exists is it's hard to be what you can't see. It's hard to build something, your career, if you've never seen someone else do it. And so the first part of the leaky pipeline for me is that part that happens from elementary school to junior high school. When I was at Garland Roads Elementary School in Lynchburg, Virginia, I was so excited one day at show and tell, the teacher asked, Edward, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I stood up proudly and I said, I want to be a scientist and an astronaut. I was the only African-American kid in my class and only one of three in the school. The teacher laughed at me. And then the whole class started laughing. And then I went to the playground, and one of the kids, not his last name will be given, but his first name was Jimmy. He used a racial epithet that and said, blank, don't become astronauts. And so my dream was devastated. I actually left school. I ran away from school and went home. And so I think that what happens is, and it's better now than the 1960s, is that people don't see what they want to be. And so they don't think they can do it. That can go through high school. When it comes to college and also at elementary school and middle school, there's inadequate preparation for the sciences. I think you both know that if you don't have a proclivity for science and you don't do well, you will never make it past bio organic chemistry in order to do well on the MCATs and get into medical school. So that's the first big part of the leaky pipeline. But when I was at Yale, I met people who had done really well on their SATs, who did really well in science, but they fell by the wayside because they had no one to kind of nurture them through different struggles, not academic, but mostly social struggles. And that's the next level of where the pipeline becomes leaky. People may have the academic ability, but they don't see a cadre of people like them, or they're not part of a group that reinforces their aspirations. And I think that lack of reinforcement of aspirations can continue into medical school. And then the final part of the leaky pipeline, which I have been heavily involved in with the Society of Black Academic Surgeons, is the concept that we refer to of mentorship, sponsorship, and even allyship. In fact, that was the title of my presidential address in 2014, and miles to go before we rest. Mentorship, sponsorship, and allyship as a way of getting people of all backgrounds from where they are to where they want to be.
Are there any specific projects, any specific medical societies that you can guide and point to our listeners who are doing something fantastic, something very helpful to the younger residents and the younger medical students wanting to excel in this field?
So in some ways, I'm a homer, meaning that I'm a big fan of SBAS. But what I would recommend for most people is your best support is going to happen locally. And the goal is not to isolate yourself and only hang around with the women you feel who are like you, who are from your background, or the men who are from your ethnicity. I think the greatest support systems that most of us will have will be across every domain in the location that we are. It's always nice to connect with people outside of your institution so that they can give you advice or perspective so that you don't feel alone or you feel that you have a friend when you go through tough times. But I would emphasize heavily that you should reach your hand and your heart out to people in your program. Learn to be vulnerable and learn to grow together and then to look for other allegiances distant.
I would like to take a step further into this conversation because being a surgeon and being a leader, you have seen so many surgical residents go in and out of the system. But at the same time, you have this unique perspective of other medical residents as well. Do you think this problem is deeper rooted in surgery, or you think that this is same in all fields of medicine?
So I think it's the same in all fields of medicine, but surgery, because of its rigor, its competitiveness, it exposes these weak spots in a much greater way. Few people would argue that surgery is a performance profession and that the stresses of performance are immediately present. I've often said as a surgeon, your dirty laundry gets displayed every week at M&M's. And as a resident, it gets displayed every day, sometimes quietly, in the call room or sometimes at the bedside. So I think it's more exposed in surgery. And also the culture of surgery creates levels of insecurity in people that make them feel more vulnerable than maybe they should. Or if someone is an underrepresented minority and not as strong, they may have some of this imposter syndrome. And so all these things converge to develop stress that leads to people wanting to avoid that stress and leaving surgery as a career, which is most unfortunate. So I think that we as leaders and is to kind of understand better the environment and understand better how we can support people in their career aspirations and leaning in. And I think that there are many pressures on people beyond ethnicity. There are life pressures, when to get married, when to childbear. Is this profession going to be friendly with all of my other life goals, whether they be geography or others? And in the old days of surgery, when I came through, we didn't give a care about that. My attendings were, you've got to give up everything to be a surgeon. And I think now that, as we're much more aware of the impact on all of us. We can be sensitive to ethnicity, gender preference, gender, life preferences, and lean in to cultivate and attract the best possible talent for surgery.
That is a great segue to my next question, which is, you know, it's match season, and we'll be getting our match results very soon here. And I know a lot of folks are excited and also really trying to fix this problem, you know, at both the resident and faculty level in programs who are trying to recruit from diverse applicant pools, get a better class that more accurately reflects our population and the patients that we treat. So what are your thoughts on, as we are looking to applicants and as we're interviewing folks and thinking about who to accept into, you know, surgical residency, how can we do a better job of encouraging these residents without just saying DEI initiatives exist at our program or paying lip service to some of these things?
Great. I so appreciate you asking me that question. I have friends across the country who have really, really senior positions in DEI at the major corporations. And when they heard me say what I'm going to say now, they attacked me because they think that I have destroyed years of DEI initiatives. But I don't like the term diversity, equity, and inclusion. I like the spirit of it, but I think the implementation often does not go in a way that promotes success. And if you look at the data, it does not, especially in medicine. And what I mean by that is that sometimes DEI is solely about representation. I think that the best approach is what I call a belonging initiative, where we create environments where everyone feels they belong and their responsibility is to help everyone else belong. And so when we create standard DEI programs, we sometimes attempt to change a climate, which is impossible to change, or to strong arm a culture that doesn't change. So what I think our programs need to focus on in their recruitment is helping everyone understand that we're going to respect your individual difference in this environment. And we want to make you thrive irrespective of how you see yourself, but more respectful of what you bring. There's a certain feeling I hear when I listen to interviews that, we think Ed Barksdale's a good fit, or we think that Shreya is a good fit. I don't like that. Instead of being a culture fit, we should think in terms of having a culture add. And that means that we are respecting what they're going to add to us, not the fact that they fit in with us. And so sometimes what the DEI programs are about is finding the right minority to fit into the culture instead of creating the environment that will make sure that whoever that is flourishes, including the white male who is the prototype. And so again, and this will be broadcast, I'll get a ton of people saying, Ed, they're not going to hear you right. But again, I think representation is absolutely important. But diversity for the sake of diversity, to me, sets up the results that we've seen here with attrition. People are brought in because of how they look, but no one is thinking about how we can make the environment such that it's sticky and that people don't want to leave because they feel they're contributing, they are wanted there, they have a place, they belong.
I have a follow-up question for you over there, Dr. Barksdale. So, you know, we're talking about match, we're talking about recruitment of younger minds coming into medicine, which is a long haul, decade worth of training. But what I feel is the most important thing is that the leadership at these hospitals who are trying to recruit also needs to have these said changes. So unless I come to a program and I'm interviewing where I see this diversity, this representation in the faculty, it's hard for it doesn't matter what they're saying in their spiel and what, how, even if they see me as an additive to their program, it doesn't make me feel seen till you see that in the faculty and the leadership. So what do you think can the hospital systems in general and big universities do in order to really change that?
I think your question is phenomenal. I think that sometimes, again, the DEI concept is lip service in order to create representation, but not to create a cultural change in the environment. What I have told the people that I sponsor, and many of the people that I mentor, but definitely the people that I sponsor, you know, if you want to know if you will succeed in a program, look at the C-suite, look at the ultimate leaders in a hospital. And sometimes the concept of DEI, and I have this in a talk, is what I call a revolving door. And so when you look at it, there's a lot of people who are diverse on the first floor, and there are not very many people who are diverse on the second floor, and there are fewer on the third or fourth floor. And when you look at the penthouse is very homogeneous, and you're not a part of that homogeneity. And I say that because one of the things that I learned as a working class kid going to New York City once, I stayed in this, I was a fencer in college, and I stayed in a penthouse suite on Central Park South. I'd never even imagined what this was. Someone was sponsoring me. And so he said, why don't you come up to my apartment? And there was a guy in the elevator, a butler in the elevator. And, you know, he put a key in. And I was like, there are no buttons. And when we went up and when we opened up the elevator opened into this apartment with this incredible view of Central Park and the entirety. And I realized that, you know, the people in the penthouse are very different than the people on the first floor. And so as a woman or minority, if you aspire to rise in surgical leadership, it's going to be so critical for you to find those buildings where you can have access to that elevator, not the stairs, because you'll get exhausted running up the stairs to get to the penthouse and the door will be locked or inaccessible. And so, again, I think that we need to put pressure on our institutions to diversify. And the way that we put pressure on them is at times there are talented people like you who decide, I'm not going to train in that institution. And, you know, if they say they want the best and the brightest, but they're not creating an environment for you to flourish, then you need to find a place where there's that person in the corner that says, come on into this elevator, let me get you to the penthouse.
It's like an elevator Sherpa, so to speak, get you the top of the fancy New York apartment building instead of Everest.
Yes. And so let me change that a bit, because someone will hear this and say, okay, that's a great metaphor. But I would say that stand back from the building and look at who's on the 10th floor, the 20th floor. It doesn't have to be at the penthouse. But again, if no one is making it to the mid-level floors, it's telling you something about the environment. The flip side is that you can look at other buildings and say that, gee, you know, let's call a place. The University of Pittsburgh has created, you know, multiple leaders elsewhere. Dean of, you know, my partner when I was there was dean of the medical school. Another is surgeon in chief. The person who trained at the University of Pittsburgh, who finished IM, is the president, who's African-American, president and CEO of the Brigham and Women's Hospitals and Mass General, that partners. He's president of the Brigham. The point is that there are certain environments in which people have paid close attention to mentoring and developing leaders. There's a woman from the University of Pittsburgh, one of my residents, who is the dean of the University of Virginia School of Medicine. So I would judge a place often by what its trainees and faculty have done once they leave.
That's great. I think, you know, we have listeners from really all stages of training and practice, and a lot of them may not be in a place where they have immediate mentorship or sponsorship that they can find. But I know that SBAS has really been that source and that resource for many trainees across the country. So yes, we're hoping you could tell us a little bit about the work you've done with SBAS in the past and currently, and how folks can get involved.
Great. Well, talking about SBAS is almost like talking about one of my children. And the reality, SBAS isn't my child. There's so many of us, particularly in my generation, who've poured so much of our heart, soul, and spirit in the cultivation of the organization. I think the first SBAS meeting was in 1987 at Duke University. And many people look at the title Society of Black Academic Surgeons, but the original group was probably about 50% African-American and non-African-American. Some pretty famous luminaries in American surgery, like David Sabiston, were a part of starting the program. And the goal was to decrease the attrition of African-Americans in surgery and to increase the representation of African-Americans in the realm of academic surgery as ultimately one day leaders in American surgery, division chiefs, department chairs, deans, and potentially CEOs. And so I would say that Ed Barksdale was of that first generation of people coming through this organization. I went to the second meeting in Boston in 1989. I was in my second year in the lab. So my fifth, when the lab after a third year, I was in my fifth year postgraduate. And from there, it's been history. There were Claude Organ, who was Mr. Everything, editor of Archives of Surgery. There was LaSalle LaFalle, who was the first African-American or second African-American president of the American College of Surgeons, head of the American Cancer Society, Mr. Everything, chairman of the department. And so there were these very senior people who helped us understand how to negotiate academia. And also, that's the mentor role. And they also helped sponsor us. But they mandated that we pay this forward. And so the organization began to grow. And so if my first meeting was in 1989, I was a regular there. I ran the program committee for a number of years. There are a group of us who just kind of developed together. And I think it was some degree of magnetism by young people coming and seeing people who look like them, who were moving up in surgery, that they said, oh, I'm smarter, taller, better looking, better surgeon than Ed Barksdale. I can do more than that. And that's what you want. You always want your own children or your professional children, and not a pedantic or condescending way, to exceed what you do. And then, so I learned in this organization all of my current thoughts and theories on mentorship and sponsorship. And in 2006, I think I felt that I did not get the complete mentorship and sponsorship that I needed to become a leader. I decided that I wanted to help create something for others. And so in 2006, I negotiated with the University of Pittsburgh in lieu of a bonus, which was going to be 25% of my salary at the time, a fairly significant bonus, to start the Society of Black Academic Surgeons Leadership Academy 1.0. And with that $50,000 donation, we developed a program that I've forgotten all the numbers now. 175 people have gone through. Patricia Turner, who is CEO of the American College, Andrea Hayes Jordan, Ayla Stanford, who ran the Black Doctors Consortium and was a CNN runner-up for CNN Hero of the Year. There are a number of people who went through this leadership program. And so it continues now. Paris Butler, I mean, there are men and women. But the point is that this was a very structured program in which people would get exposure to potential mentors and sponsors who could help advance their career. And when I think about the Leadership Academy 1.0, different from now, it was like a lattice or a scaffold that was laid out for people to attempt to climb up when there was no scaffold before. And you know, I think that's what we all must do, regardless of ethnicity. We have to think about, as what my grandmother would say, how we can plant trees in whose shade we'll never sit. And that becomes the approach. So I am very excited about SBAS. And I think that if you listen to the leaders of the AWS and the Asian, they will say that they've used the model of SBAS to build their programs. We are cohesive. And of course, we're surgeons. We're occasionally competitive. But the opportunity to meet with people who share your background, your perspective, but who you can also share your strength with to empower them has been really important. And so if I tell you that I love the concept of SBAS because I'm African-American, I love the concept of SBAS because I'm a surgeon. And what I mean is that this should be the format by which we develop surgery at the University of Washington for everyone, or at Case Western Reserve, that we think about the ways to be closer and to nurture each other and to recognize that there are going to be some people who are basic science inclined, some who are going to want to do advanced clinical practice or clinical trials, and some of those who may want to be in private practice, but develop means of having everyone feel that they belong and their talents can be nurtured and developed.
Well, thank you, Dr. Barksdale. I think that our next generation will definitely be standing on shoulders of giants like you who have put in so much of the foundational work in SBAS and other institutions and in so many other ways that you have given back to the community as well as the surgical residency. We really appreciate it. I hope that our conversation in this episode has pull some strings and given some perspective to people who are looking for mentorship. And like Nina said, sometimes that's not so readily available. So we really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much for inviting me. And I want to end with a statement about something you just said. It's out of ego sometimes we say that we're standing on the shoulders of giants, as I think Asimov said, so we can see further. But I wonder what happens when those giants fail or when they fall. I think it is our goal to look at those people that we have giant, that we think of as giants, but to forge a new path and to understand what they did, not create their mistakes, and honor and respect them, but truly the standing on their shoulders, I sometimes worry, is too ego-driven by the giants and not creative enough by the next generation. So I would encourage those of you who are listening is to be creative, to be collaborative, and to recognize how you can advance the field by advancing others and by also heavily focusing on the care that we provide for patients in a way that will promote great outcomes as well as equity. Thank you so much.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org for more great content. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please take a minute to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening.
Until next time, dominate the day.